Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 15th of July. This hour of the program, we're going to be talking about Judge Sonia Sotomayor's hearings, and our guest says that the confirmation odds are in her favor. Joining us this hour is Professor Katie Harriger, professor and chair of Wake Forest University's Department of Political Science. She has been studying the Supreme Court for quite some years. And she says that unless something no one knows about right now comes out of the process, the odds of confirmation are in her favor, given the political context. We have a sizable Democratic majority in the Senate, several Republican senators that have supported her in past nominations to a lower court, and the Republican Party concerned about further alienating Hispanic voters. Professor Harriger is nationally known for her expertise on the Supreme Court, the separation of powers, and the federal special prosecutor. Her current research includes race and the Supreme Court. We'll be welcoming phone calls from you. Many of you have been watching the hearings. What do you think? Lindsey Graham said yesterday, we're trying to figure out who are we getting here, said Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. You know, who are we getting as a nation? And I guess that's the question of the hour, which we will be attempting to answer with our guest, Professor Katie Harriger. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
What a grueling thing this is to sit there for hour after hour after hour after hour, and then the next day again, huh?
Yeah. And there's more to come.
And there is more to come. How many more days does this grueling testimony continue? Is it? I know they're bringing in people to attest to her character.
Today may be her last day, because then we have the witnesses from both sides. And the hearing is just expected to last just this week.
Mm-hmm. So Lindsey Graham asked this question. We're trying to figure out who are we getting here? Who are we getting as a nation? Which, you know, is an interesting kind of question. Mm-hmm. From what you saw yesterday, who do you think we're getting here as a nation?
Well, you know, I think what we saw yesterday is one version of Sonia Sotomayor, which is reflected in her judicial behavior in the years that she's been on the court, which is a very cautious, measured sort of person. I think what the Republicans worry about is that she also has a kind of history of activism in the area of women's rights and Latino rights, and they're worried that that's the judge they're going to get.
Mm-hmm. But she addressed that right on, didn't she? When asked, she said, I put my activism behind when George Herbert Walker Bush appointed me to the court.
Which was, I thought, a clever answer.
Yes, wasn't it? It really was a very good answer. You know, the one thing that bugged me about these hearings is, what is this about bringing up her temperament? When has this ever happened to a guy? Phrases like a bit of a bully, a terror on the bench, and she said that she only asks tough questions during hearings. It seems to me that there's a bit of sexism with that kind of question. Do you think, am I hearing something that's not there?
No, I mean, that's my reaction to it, but maybe we react that way because we're women.
Yeah.
But I do think that her style, which is apparently fairly aggressive from the bench, is one that many male appellate judges have, and especially the ones who come from being sort of law professor backgrounds, where, you know, that's kind of their style.
Mm-hmm.
And so it has struck me as sexist in the concern that she's more, you know, when women are aggressive, that somehow there's something wrong with that.
Right. I just can't recall that being asked.
No, I don't have any recollection of that either, even though Justice Scalia, for example, has a similar kind of reputation.
Yeah, right. And it's talked about when it comes to presidential campaigns sometimes, but it's never judged against a character. He's got a bit of a temper, and it's usually he's the one who's got a bit of a temper.
Right. But it is, you know, the issue is all around this sort of question of judicial temperament and what is judicial temperament. And I think the ideal is usually seen as someone who never lets on, whether they're skeptical about an argument or but clearly on the Supreme Court, that hasn't been the case for years.
Yeah. And what about temperament? Does that make a difference here in terms of what you get out of a witness? And is there an ideal kind of temperament?
Well, I think that the ideal temperament, if I do think there probably is one for a judge, which is that they are able to attempt to be as impartial as possible. And and to provide the appearance of that so that people that are in front of them don't feel as if they're already prejudged.
Mm-hmm. She is going to have people testifying on her behalf. I understand Mayor Bloomberg is going to be in Washington today. Who will be testifying on her behalf, do we know, and who will be testifying not on her behalf?
Yeah, I think the people who are testifying on her behalf are people that she has worked with in the past or who know her through her years in the New York legal establishment. I'm sure Bloomberg is there in part for that reason. Morgan Thau, the sort of famous district attorney from New York with whom she kind of got her start, will be testifying on her behalf. The head of the National Police Association, she's generally seen as being quite good on criminal justice issues because she spent so much time as a prosecutor.
Mm-hmm.
Women's Lawyer Organization, Puerto Rican Lawyer Association, so various groups that will support her claim, you know, of a very impressive legal career.
You have said that unless something no one knows about right now comes out in the process, the odds of confirmation are in her favor. We'll talk about why they're in her favor. But so far, there hasn't been anything where everybody's eyes open and say, oh, my gosh, I didn't know this.
No, and, you know, and that would be surprising if it happened. First of all, I think presidents most of the time are extremely careful about vetting people beforehand nowadays so that you don't get surprises. And then nominees spend a good deal of time being coached, you know, with aggressive questioning and, you know, practicing their answers. So, you know, so far I haven't seen anything that's the least bit surprising. It's sort of political theater, only one you've seen many times already.
Right. And you do say that the confirmation, the odds are in her favor. Can you detail that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it is in the end a political process. And so you look at what's the majority on the Senate, and it's clearly, especially now that Al Franken has joined, you know, there's a filibuster-proof majority there. So, I mean, she can get confirmed with the 60 votes, and they can't filibuster it.
Mm-hmm.
But in addition, I think there are Republicans who are going to vote for her. And in particular, I think the two women from Maine, you know, where Republicans in New England are an endangered species.
Right.
And I think that they both voted for her when she was approved for the Second Circuit. And I don't think anything has been revealed that would be different, you know, that would suggest that sometime between when she went on the Second Circuit and now that she has somehow revealed herself not to be a good choice.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think, as I'm not the first person to mention this, that the Republicans are concerned about being careful about how they deal with the issue of her being a Hispanic, because they're very aware that they're in danger of further alienating that group of voters.
Right.
And so I think, you know, that whole political context, I think, suggests once the theater is over, the outcome's pretty certain.
Obviously, the big comment that was circulated ad nauseum before these hearings started were her comments about a wise Latina.
Mm-hmm.
What did you think about this? She kind of preempted the question about it yesterday.
Yeah.
by talking about Sandra Day O'Connor and what she meant here. Was it front and center? Did she answer it fully? Did she sway opinions?
I doubt she swayed any opinions. I think it's interesting that when you look at sort of what the Republicans' attack is, it's almost completely based on things she's given in the context of speeches to various organizations, and virtually none of it, with the exception maybe of the Ritchie case, is anything on case law. And so they've latched on to that as, in most cases, I think, taken out of context. The wise Latina one is probably the most troublesome for her, but I think she handled it the best way she could, which is to say, well, you know, in retrospect, I might have chosen different words, and I don't actually believe that women are necessarily better judges than men or that any group has a particular corner on.
Mm-hmm.
True. So I think her answer has been as good as it can be, given that that's out there. But I don't think it's going to assuage the concerns of the people who are using it.
And what about the Ritchie case? She talked about that yesterday as well.
Yeah, you know, to me, that's a perfect example of the difficulty of trying to explain complex constitutional law issues, you know, on television, for example. Because she's correct when she says the issue before her was this was not a quota issue. There was no claim that there was a quota. And so the law on affirmative action in that particular area really wasn't applicable. Instead, it was really kind of a technical question about how to interpret two competing parts of the Civil Rights Act. And they based the decision on the precedent established in the Second Circuit. So it's correct when she says that the Supreme Court has now, by overturning the Second Circuit, has now established a new rule, but it's not a rule that existed when they made the decision.
Mm-hmm.
But that's as I just demonstrated, it's a technical kind of legal issue that's hard to translate into sort of popular understanding.
Are there many more cases of that nature and broader cases that deal more with affirmative action that the court will be considering soon?
That issue's not going to go away. And now, as a result of the Ritchie decision, there'll be a whole new kind of line of litigation about what cities and employers and stuff have to consider in trying to interpret the Civil Rights Act. I also think it's very possible that Congress will at least consider legislation and possibly pass legislation to tell the court that they've misinterpreted the statute.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not over, I don't think, as an issue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What about guns? Did she say anything surprising about the Second Amendment yesterday?
I read her comments as agreeing with the majority that there is an individual right in the Second Amendment to bear arms. The big question that people had after that decision was made last year was, what does this mean for the states? Because they purposely avoided that question. And so that's what's happening now at the Second Circuit. I mean, at the various circuit level courts, you're getting different outcomes. And so the court's definitely going to reconsider that case on this question of whether that decision, because remember, that decision was about D.C.
Right.
And D.C.'s not a state.
Right.
And so the question is, does the Second Amendment actually apply to state governments and local governments?
Mm-hmm.
And that's an unresolved question.
Hmm. It's been an unresolved question for a long time, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Her comments on Roe v. Wade?
Very predictable. I think, in fact, if you look, they're not that different from things that Alito and Roberts said in their hearing. Very similar kind of language, which is, this is established precedent. I'm not going to say what I actually think because more cases could come before us. I mean, that's become the standard line of nominees, and I didn't hear anything different.
Mm-hmm. In terms of how she may have voted when it came to Gore-Bush mm-hmm. election, Supreme Court taking the case.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was a good answer, actually. I mean, again, she wasn't going to take a position, as I think she. I don't think she did really on any of those cases that she was asked about.
Mm-hmm.
But what I thought I liked as a political scientist is the way in which she then expanded it to the ongoing kind of dialogue or debate, the impact that it had on the electoral process and those kinds of things. Recognizing that the Supreme Court's not necessarily the final word on issues of law, that it then gets debated in the public realm as well.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was a good answer.
Yeah. Overall, it's been described, the Washington Post doing winners and losers in yesterday's performance and calling her a winner and saying this about her, add or agree or disagree, measured, confident, deferential, seemingly relaxed. She was rock solid mm-hmm. in her second day in front of the Judiciary Committee.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think some of the with Lindsey Graham pursuing the issues about her temperament and thing, I think one strategy of theirs may have been to see if they could get her to become angry, for example, and to react angrily, in which then they could then show there's proof, of her temperament problems. So if that were the strategy, and that's my speculation, but if that was the strategy, it clearly didn't work. So I thought she came across as, I think I said at the beginning, the kind of judge that her actual record reflects, which is very careful and measured.
Isn't it interesting? I was thinking as I was watching, I didn't see all of it, but some of it yesterday. Here is this person that's going to have such an important role in the government. And it was so interesting just to hear her. We hadn't heard mm-hmm. her very much. And I thought, here's a voice that and a face that if she is confirmed, we're going to see for a long time. And mm-hmm. we're just meeting her.
Yeah. And, I think as much as skeptical as I am about the, as I keep calling it, the political theater of the hearings, I do think, if I could sort of point to the one thing I think is valuable about them, is that the Supreme Court really kind of operates behind this, you know, curtain so much of the time that it's the one opportunity people have to actually sort of see who these people are in any kind of extended way.
Right.
And so in that sense, I do think there's some educational value, as long as people understand sort of what's really going on.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls. They're coming in great numbers right now. So we're going to go to your calls. We're looking at the Judge Sonia Sotomayor hearings, which are continuing today. They were, as you know, on all day yesterday, and I'm sure many of you had a chance to see them. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you want to send an email, you can do that. It's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. We'll also talk about Sotomayor breaking with Barack Obama when asked whether she agreed with the idea that in 5% of cases, a judge's heart leads her, him or her to a decision. Her answer to that, I thought, was rather interesting, and I wonder what our guest thinks about that as well. To you in just a moment, I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is Professor Katie Herriger, Professor and Chair, Department of Political Science at Wake Forest University. And our phone number is 800-486-8655. We start with Scott from Green Bay. Hi, Scott.
Good morning.
Hi.
A couple of comments. First off, I think she's totally qualified. Elections mean things, and this is President Obama has picked, and I think she'll get in and get confirmed. My issue is more with how the debate is being framed more than anything else. I have an issue with that Republicans need to be touchy because she's a Hispanic and we don't want to alienate the Hispanic vote. That was never an issue when the Democrats held up Miguel Estrada and when Dick Durbin had a memo saying, we don't want him in because he probably will be a nominee on the bench, and we do not want a Republican to place the first Hispanic on the bench. That really bothers me that the debates are being framed differently. Secondly, my other point is President Obama did not vote for Alito or Roberts. Now, let's just take Roberts, who is incredibly qualified. If we use Barack Obama's rationale for voting for a Supreme Court justice, none of the Republicans should vote for him. Republicans don't vote for a Democrat. It's partisan. When Democrats don't vote for a Republican candidate, it's standing on principle. I mean, very few Democrats voted for Alito or Roberts. And I just think the debate in the press is framed differently when it's a Democrat nominee or a Republican nominee. And those are examples that are true and factual that I just gave.
Mm-hmm. Professor Herriger.
Yeah, well, let me correct one thing. It is true that the vote on Alito was quite close, but the vote on Roberts was not. He got more than 70 votes, and so a substantial number of Democrats did vote for him. So I would make a distinction between those two. And Alito was perceived as being maybe more ideological than Roberts at the time, which I think is the reason. I think Scott's right that with each nominee, you sort of the issues get framed somewhat differently. I'm not sure that I would characterize the Democrats as having one approach and the Republicans having another. I think it's really about what's the political context at the time. And I guess I see it this way because I'm a political scientist. I'm sort of like, what is the motivation of particular individuals for voting the way they vote? And when I keep referring to these hearings as sort of political theater, I'm referring to it really as about all those speeches that are going on are not at her or even for the audience in the room. They're really for constituents. And I think in the end, people vote the way they vote because they perceive that the people who support them in their particular state want them to go one way or the other. And that's based on political calculations.
Scott, thank you very much for the call. Wait, how many people are on that committee? Did I hear 12-7, the votes likely to go from the Judiciary Committee?
Yeah, so there's 12 Democrats and 7 Republicans.
Yeah. Jerry from Madison is next. Hi, Jerry.
Good morning, Kathleen. I would suggest that there is no such thing as an unbiased white male judge either. I would cite a documentary that I'd seen a few years back where large corporations would invite white male judges at the higher level, the appellate level and the federal level, to lavish retreats, golf outings, etc., for the purpose of grooming them so that they will eventually make the quote-unquote right decisions.
Oh, okay. Is there a question?
No, a comment.
Okay, yeah. Well, you know, I would say this sort of from the political science perspective, there's been a considerable amount of work and research that suggests that the notion of a completely unbiased judge is kind of a strange concept. In other words, clearly judges have, at the very least, some what we might call an ideological bias of one way or the other, and presidents know that, and they pick them for that reason. In other words, the Republican presidents have picked people with, you know, Justice Roberts has very good qualifications in the sort of, you know, meritorious sense, but he also pretty clearly had the right ideological qualifications for Bush to pick him, and the same with Justice Alito, and I would say that's the same thing that Obama is doing here. And so presidents have recognized, certainly in modern times, that judges, who a judge is, does make a difference, and that there are ideological directions in terms of which way judges go. So I think that Jerry's right, that the kind of notion that we can find a sort of perfectly unbiased person. I think where you do want a lack of bias is in the willingness to look at each case anew and to try to figure out what's the fair thing to do, and you wouldn't want a personal bias of some sort to come into play. But sort of broad ideological bias is there, and the evidence is very strong that it's there.
Anything else?
No, that will cover it. Thank you.
Thanks, Jerry. Thanks for the call. Let's talk a little bit about this area, which is, a little bit amorphous. So tell me but I think it's an important area. When she was asked whether she agreed with the idea, which was given by President Obama, in 5% of cases, a judge's heart leads him or her to his decision. Her answer, I wouldn't approach the issue of judging in the way the president does. He has to explain what he meant by judging. I can only explain what I think judges should do, which is judges can't rely on what's in their heart.
Right.
What do you think the president meant by that? And what do you think she meant?
Yeah, I mean, this could be one of those situations where they're both right.
Mm.
But depending on, what exactly they're trying to say. And I'm sure it doesn't surprise me at all that she responded in that way because of the concern that the Republican senators have raised that she's, that empathy is not a legitimate sort of decision-making criteria. it doesn't surprise me that she responded that way. But, my understanding of Obama's statement was that, and this is particularly true at the Supreme Court level, the cases that the Supreme Court takes are cases where law is unsettled. Where the law is very clear, it gets resolved, either at the lawyer's office where the lawyer tells them you don't have a case, or at the trial level or at the circuit court level. And so the cases the Supreme Court takes are cases where the law is less clear. There's not crystal clear answers, because if the answer were crystal clear, it wouldn't be there, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're there to resolve the ambiguity. And so in the context of where he made that statement, he was saying, it's that small percentage of cases that worry me, where I do think ideological leanings come into play. And he used the word heart, but I think what he was referring to is ideological leanings. And, people's ideologies are tied in some way to their heart and to their gut reaction and to their experiences in life and all those kinds of things that are getting discussed.
Sure.
So I think that was his statement. And I think she gave the only answer that she could give, given the context of what the issues are that have been raised
right
in this hearing.
It seems to me that that's a low figure.
I think it is probably a low figure.
Do you think so?
For the Supreme Court.
Right.
Yeah.
All right, let's go back to phone calls. Roger from Fox County is next. Hi, Roger.
Hi, from Sauk County.
Sauk County, sorry.
That's okay. I don't have the statistics in front of me, but I've heard many news reports over the last 5 to 20 years that our prison population is not representative of our general population, percentage-wise, by ethnic groups.
Or gender.
And that also, many times, a white judge, if you look at the history and if you look at our country, minorities, particularly blacks, are given more strict or more long sentences. So I know Sonia probably isn't in a position to use that as her defense, but I really would like to hear somebody in the media talk about white men judges aren't neutral either, and they have ethnic bias for their group often, and it, and we have the statistics about it. So my question is, talk a little bit about that, and why do you think no one in the media is really talking about that?
Yeah, well, I read an article recently, and I'm afraid I can't remember who wrote it, but you know what? It might have been Eugene Robinson, arguing that what seems to have become the case is that the white male viewpoint in the law has become the presumptively neutral position, and that any other position is therefore sort of assumed to be biased in one direction or the other, instead of recognizing that they all might be positions that are out there that are shaped by, which I thought was a thoughtful way of trying to think through what I think is a pretty complex issue and question. I mean, the research that I've seen that's been done on judges and criminal justice, for example, don't show a significant bias. Interesting enough, sometimes women judges, for example, are sometimes harder in criminal justice cases than male judges, to the extent that any difference appears. And so I think it's a pretty complex one. I think one of the things you're identifying is that there does appear to be a bias in the actual laws in terms of the sentences given for particular kinds of crimes. And so you end up, you know, the popular one that's been talked about is the difference between crack cocaine and powder cocaine. The penalties are so much different, and if you have one sort of class of people who tend to use one kind of drug and another tend to do the other, you get a biased outcome, right, in terms of who ends up with the long prison term.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Mike. And we have a couple lines open. We've been crowded here. So if you've been trying to get through, now is a good time for you to try again because you'll meet with success. 800-486-8655 is the number. Mike from Appleton is next. Hello, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. I'm going to throw a monkey wrench into the works here. It seems to me that the selection of the Supreme Court is inherently unfair because here we're not selecting. Somebody else is selecting somebody who's going to be in office for life. I mean, it's conceivable that that would be 40 years. And so the population really has no choice as to who the Supreme Court person is going to be. That person is there for life. Is selected by, yes, an elected official, but, you know, we're not selecting or electing that person in a direct basis, and that person is going to have an impact on our lives for a long, long time.
You think we should elect our Supreme Court justices?
Pardon me?
You think we should elect them?
I would think. I mean, we elect the president and the Congress and our state representatives and everybody else, you know, every 4 years or whatever it is. We have a turnover of people and ideas. But here, we're subject to, you know, the decisions that this person is going to take for an extended period of time. Mm-hmm. And it just doesn't seem to make any sense.
What do you think,
Yeah,
Professor?
Well, Mike raises some interesting and actually important questions, I think, that have not people have raised them before. I think the place you have to start is sort of why did we end up with the system that we have? And at the time that the Constitution was written, I think the belief pretty clearly was that judging is something different from lawmaking or executing the law. Alexander Hamilton wrote one of the Federalist Papers about justifying life tenure, and his argument was that you needed judges that were removed from politics so that they could look at the law and try to be as fair and unbiased as possible. So removing them from politics would help ensure the one characteristic that I think everybody in this debate agrees you want judges to have, which is impartiality. Right? So if you're subject to election, the presumption was that you're then going to be partial to the people who put you in, right? I think that notion has been challenged in the 20th century, partly by the research I mentioned earlier that shows, I mean, we're now very aware that judges do have ideological bias, and it does affect the way they interpret the law, and presidents can make a difference in terms of, you know, which direction the law goes. I think this may not be any consolation to Mike, but the argument is that there is kind of an indirect control through the election process. So the fact that Obama got elected by the margins he did and that the Democrats have the margin in the Senate that they have means in some ways the outcome of the election is being reflected in that choice, in the same way that Bush was able to put, you know, when he had the electoral majority, was able to put people who reflected his views on. So, but it's very indirect and probably not satisfactory to Mike's concerns. There has been some discussion that the problem with life tenure now is that it used to be that judges were much older when they were put on the court, and so life tenure didn't mean 30 or 40 years of influence, except for, you know, very few judges. But now presidents, again, strategically have recognized the kind of impact that they can have long term, and they have started putting younger and younger people on the court. And so life tenure now, you know, might mean 30 years or more of someone's life. And so there's been some discussion about having a 18-year term, which would give people more insulation but would still ensure some of that new voice that Mike mentions would be valuable.
What do you think of that? Would that be a good idea?
The 18-year?
Yeah.
You know, I find it interesting. I haven't ruled it out.
Mm-hmm.
Because I do think that it can be a problem if you... I think the original intent of life tenure was not to put people in their 40s on the court. Or, of course, you know, at the end of the, you know, in the 18th century, life expectancy was considerably shorter,
right,
as well. So I don't think it was imagined that you would have the amount of lag time that's there that a president can influence,
mm-hmm,
the law. I guess one other thing I'd like to challenge is Mike's notion that that the people are sort of stuck with what the Supreme Court decides. And I think there's plenty of evidence throughout our history that when public opinion is substantially opposed to what the court has done, it tends to change.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the famous, what's called the switch in time that saved nine at the time of the Great Depression, you know, when clearly Congress and the president had a particular direction to go and the court was resisting and striking down the New Deal legislation. And in the end, the court switched. I mean, they couldn't withstand the political pressure in the end. And so I don't think the notion that the court gets the final word and if we disagree, that's the end of the story is really true.
Mm-hmm. Can you imagine what a circus would be, though, if there were a national election, the money that would be involved in this? I would think it would be incredible.
I actually don't think it's a good idea to elect judges, frankly. I should make that clear.
Well, yeah, there's a debate.
And I think that recent case from West Virginia is like Exhibit A,
mm-hmm,
you know, where somebody spent a considerable amount of money and then had his case come before the court, and, you know, the Supreme Court said, yeah, the facts of this case are so disturbing that there needs to be some kind of rule about this. So I actually don't think, but many of my colleagues would disagree with that. They think the accountability, and this is the issue I think Mike's raising,
right,
the accountability that comes with elections is more valuable than the perceived independence that comes.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Mike, very much for the call. We go to John next from Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Well, just to refresh everybody's memory, the court changed in the 1930s because Roosevelt appointed Black and Douglas, those same people.
Well, but the other guys had to resign, and the vote changed actually before Roosevelt was the court.
Well, it still was a 5-4 vote on Republic Steel that certified the National Labor Relations Act, and I think this is one of the litmus tests for Sotomayor that she's going to face, not necessarily in confirmation, but down the road, because she does have, she was a Republican appointee originally to the, mm-hmm, bench. She doesn't have a very good track record on labor issues. Yesterday we had Mr. Obama and Warren stating that the automobile jobs are perhaps gone forever.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't see any national AFL-CIO or even state AFL-CIO people come out to support this nomination enthusiastically.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is that we've lived under a court for 30 years now that has decimated both the National Labor Relations Act and the National Labor Relations Board, and somehow we, those of us left in organized labor, are supposed to accept this as a rule of law when this is nothing more than ideological hatred of working class people. And we needed a very firm judge to be supported and nominated by Obama initially to give organized labor the sense that they will have some hope for the future. And instead, he nominated this probably very easily confirmed justice who is really not that much different on labor issues than Alito, Roberts, or Scalia.
Who are you supporting, John? Who would you have preferred?
I don't think that there's much out there to tell you the truth, because we've nominated these federal judges for years now that have had an ideological hatred toward labor. So there aren't these experienced judges like Douglas and Black to call from and choose from.
Mm-hmm. Professor Herriger.
Well, you know, I think John raises a couple of interesting and important questions. I think he's right that there hasn't been, labor hasn't been perceived as being one of the legal issues to fight over in terms of these nominations. And one of the things I've said for a long time is this kind of, while I think the issue of abortion is important, for example, you know, there's a lot of issues that the Supreme Court deals with, and somehow they never even get discussed. You know, there's so much. So this time around, abortion is sort of taking a second seat to affirmative action as the primary issue. But, you know, there's all these other issues that the court has to deal with that Congress is just not exploring. And labor certainly would be one of them. I think he's correct that we have a pretty pro-business court, and even, you know, the Democratic nominees haven't been, as he correctly points out, haven't been the Douglases and Blacks. But I think part of that is, you know, what are the sort of, some of that's the larger issue, the problems labor has in the larger political realm. So there isn't a perception that it's going to matter if you don't put strong labor on there. Whereas in the political context of the Roosevelt appointees, that was one of the critical issues of the day, right? Mm-hmm. I agree with John that it continues to be a critical issue. But what happens with these nominations is only one or, you know, all the space gets sucked up by the one or two issues that the interest groups are primarily concerned about. And so in this particular nomination, it's sort of issues of race and identity and, really only secondarily, I think, on the issue of abortion. But labor issues are important. Environmental issues are important. This court has been fairly hostile to environmental concerns. The notion of presidential power and how much presidential power there is very important. And those issues don't seem to get discussed because of the perception, I think, by the participants about who cares enough to get motivated. I would want to just say one thing, and that is, I'm starting to sound like a broken record on this, but the place to have the greatest impact on the law involving labor is in Congress. I mean, if the court's not interpreting the National Labor Relations Act the way it should be interpreted, Congress can change that by changing the law. And so I would think that's where labor ought to put their effort.
And thanks for the call, John. One line is open. Our number, 800-486-8655. We're talking about the Judge Sonia Sotomayor Supreme Court hearings that are taking place in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee. The hearing's going on again today, so we're discussing what happened yesterday, what's likely to happen today, and all of that. Our guest is Professor Katie Herriger, professor and chair, Department of Political Science at Wake Forest University, and she has been following the court, for quite some time. It's her what she does professionally, and she is has a special interest in race and the Supreme Court. Okay, back to you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Just a brief announcement about a previous show earlier in July. Nancy Pearl was with us to talk about summer reading and her book recommendations. And we do have the book recommendations that she gave us and some that you gave us as well, which are now on our website. So it's WPR.org. Go to my name, Kathleen Dunn, and you'll find Nancy's book recommendations so you can have a whale of a summer reading. Back to phone calls. Paul from St. Paul. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
The question that I have really relates to the fact that we keep seeing clips of Lindsey Graham talking about how if he made comments akin to Judge Sotomayor's, that he would already have lost his job and his career would be over, et cetera. And every time I hear that, it makes me wonder if, in fact, there isn't really a legitimate sort of asymmetry between what a white man who is, you know, arguably, for better or worse, a member of the oppressing class historically, and what a member of an oppressed class can say. I mean, it sort of seems like there is a natural asymmetry there, and that someone like Judge Sotomayor or a member of any sort of oppressed minority should have more latitude in what they can say in the kind of context that she's speaking, mm-hmm. than a white man would. And I'll hang up and enjoy your response.
There's an interesting question, Professor.
It is an interesting question, and I think that I agree with Paul that I you do have to think about sort of context in that. You know, I'm sure that, in fact, I think she said so yesterday, that Sonia Sotomayor would like to have back that statement because of the way that it's been interpreted and the way it sounds. If I had to point to the one thing that somebody said yesterday that probably had the most people nodding their heads, it was probably that statement by Lindsey Graham. And I think she did a pretty good job of responding to it. But I do think the context matters. I think this is Paul's point, is that what she says, and I take her at her word, is that if she's invited to come and talk to a group of women attorneys or Latino attorneys and wants to encourage them to believe that they can be a judge too, then saying these kinds of things, that your voice matters, that your, which is how I take her to, what I take her to have been saying, your voice would matter too in the law, and the law would be better if more voices were there. Then I think that's an understandable context. If she said exactly the same thing from the bench, or if Lindsey Graham said it from the floor of the Senate, then I think that would be a different context. But it's touchy. I mean, I think it's a difficult issue, and I can see why someone like Lindsey Graham feels that way. Mm-hmm. I think that was a sincere statement on his part.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Paul. Anne from Madison. Hi.
Hi. Well, I assume that President Obama knows how she feels about these issues.
Uh-huh.
Maybe the present senators should read some of the Senate investigative hearings from 40 or 50 years ago, when a lot of research was done and the questions were really probing. They weren't about things like, you think you're, you know, better than white men, and
right.
Just the idiocy that's been demonstrated here. But if I were questioning her, I would ask her how she feels about the principle of habeas corpus, and how she feels about the trials by military commission that BBC, no American medium I've heard, but BBC announced yesterday we're going to continue now with some tweaking by, I suppose, President Obama and Attorney General Holder, because every public official at that level takes an oath to uphold the Constitution, and Congress has allowed the Constitution to be shredded. The Supreme Court has acquitted itself fairly well in that mm-hmm. department so far, but I assume there will be many more lawsuits contesting, you know, this new kind of very amorphous justice that mm-hmm. the Obama administration is approving, just as the Bush administration ordered.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I have a couple of responses to that. I think that one of the reasons they're asking the stupid question, as you I think correctly characterize them, is because on the basis of the judicial record, there's really nothing to go after her for. And for people on the left, that might actually be an issue of concern. I think I heard that in John's earlier question about labor, because of the kind of cautious judge she has been. But I think what's really the kinds of questions we're getting are really because this is about television. You know, back in the day that you, as you refer to the more serious hearings, those were not televised hearings, and so I think they focused on the kind of legal issues that you're wishing they were focusing on now. I think on the particular questions about habeas corpus and the military commissions, I think you're right. The court has, but by increasingly narrow margins, acquitted itself pretty well on that on those questions. I don't think if they asked her directly about military commissions, I don't think she's going to answer that question for the same reason no nominee will anymore if they think it's a case that's going to come before them. But I do think, and this goes back to the point I made earlier about the issues that get ignored, I think it's perfectly legitimate and that she should answer questions about how she understands the separation of powers, what's the relationship between you know, the judiciary and the executive, for example, which I think is one of the key questions in the military commissions. In other words, to try to get at the broader philosophy that might tell us whether she agrees with people like Alito and Scalia who think the president has enormous power in this area, or whether she's more in line with those who have checked the president.
Let's go next. Thanks, Ann. Scott from La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi there. Unfortunately, John, that darn John from Milwaukee.
Oh, that darn John.
What I was going to ask about is the role of special and particularly corporate interest money in having the best little Congress money can buy, and possibly the best little court system money can buy. Since I've heard that the Roberts and Alitos of the world have no problem in being conservative or backing hot button social issues from the right side, but that their real value is their ability to represent corporate interests on all the cases we don't hear about.
Right, and that nobody talks about because they're not as interesting on television.
Exactly, but that they really have a lot more impact from a lot more people.
I think that's right. I think that those are the unexamined questions that make a big difference, and probably a bigger difference. There's many more cases that deal with those kinds of issues than there are the hot button issues, which are few and far between, really. Mm-hmm. But you know, the nature of the selection process and the politics of it has now become to focus on those.
But that's been covered, let me ask you this. I heard somebody say yesterday that the questioning from the members of Congress or the senators to her really have less to do with her nomination than setting down markers for the future. Mm-hmm. And I guess I would like to know how valid that premise is, and what kind of markers do you think are being really established that are going to somehow
question.
Impact the next nomination that's sent up?
Right. I think there's some truth to that, although I think I agree with the notion that this isn't really about her. But I think it's more about speaking to the various constituencies that give you money as a senator. The interest groups that you perceive care about this. And I say that for both sides of the aisle. There are mobilized interests that care a lot about the particular issues, and that's why they're driving the agenda in terms of the issues that are being discussed and the speeches, you know, the focus of the speeches. But in terms of the markers for the future, I do think I think everyone knows this one's going to go. And in some ways, the opposition is okay with that because she replaces somebody who's not going to tip the ideological balance of the court, right? I mean, she's probably going to be pretty much like Souter.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's less, you know, to battle about. But the markers for the future would be, you know, if your next person is someone who might tip the balance, you're going to have more trouble, right? So we're going to lay out the groundwork, you know, that on affirmative action, on race, you know, an issue where they think that has some traction with a broader group of the public.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can just imagine what that battle will be like.
Yeah, and I think that's what they're going to save their energy and their firepower for that.
Mm-hmm. So your prediction is she'll pass pretty easily, or will she get a lot of Republicans voting against her?
I think there will be a fair number of Republicans voting against her, but I also think she'll get some Republican votes. And I mean, the estimate that I've heard as a reasonable one is you know, 65, 70 votes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the Democrats will support her.
Right.
And then she will get some Republican votes.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Professor Herriger, for being with us.
Okay, it was my
pleasure.
Enjoyed
it. Thanks. Professor Katie Herriger, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Wake Forest University, and has a special interest in race and the Supreme Court, talking about the Sotomayor hearings. We also want to tell you, let me remind you, that there are special NPR coverage this evening on Point. The first hour will have a summary of all of today's events, and Talk of the Nation is dealing with this issue as well. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to Rob Schroeder and Rachel Biblow for on-air production. And thanks, everybody, for your calls. We'll return following the news.